You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
Good Sunday morning, New England. You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. The distinguished man sitting right in front of me, that's Terry Hendricks. I'm John Featherston. Good morning. And we want to get right to our phone because we've got a special guest joining us, and I appreciate the fact that he's taking time on a Sunday morning to join us. We've got Sheriff Thomas Hodgkins from Bristol County joining us. Good morning, Sheriff. How are you?
I can hear you. How are you?
Hey, good morning. Sorry about that. You know, it helps sometimes if you push the button and everything like that. Hey, thanks for taking the time to join us here on All Politics is Local. Terry Hendricks, John Featherston. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in Bristol County in your office.
Well, we're dealing with the same problems in our county as everybody is with regards to the opioid crisis. We've just gotten a major grant from the state to try to see if we can do some interdiction and minimize this epidemic and start to turn the wave back toward more responsible decisions on the part of people getting involved with the opioid problem. We're involved, of course, with MetroLink and marshaling our forces around this whole issue of the marginalization of law enforcement and trying to do all we can to partner with other law enforcement agencies with the growing threat against law enforcement. And I've just recently come back from Washington, actually, where I had a chance to address both the Secretary of Homeland Security as well as the Attorney General on some very serious problems that are facing law enforcement and that we believe are really, in some part, orchestrated by the administration. So lots to do, lots to going on, and we're doing all we can on our part to try to see if we can mitigate some of these problems.
Well, what do you think about the ballot question to basically expand marijuana in the Commonwealth?
Well, I can't think of anything worse for the people of Massachusetts when we start sending a message to children and anyone really that we're going to ignore the science and the clear evidence. I mean, anybody that works in the prisons will tell you that, you know, we do a SLAM program here where we actually bring about 3 busloads of kids a week into our facility where they get a chance to hear from 2 or 3 inmates about what life's like in prison and how they ended up coming here. And every one of them that's been involved in drugs, and that's about 80% here, will tell you that the gateway for them was using marijuana. And it's no secret. Everybody knows it. And I've always sort of scratched my head and asked, why would anybody in public service want to introduce another mind-altering drug that we know is going to give you absolutely nothing to improve your life? If anything, it's going to create some serious problems for you. And we already know the effects of alcohol. Why would we want to at all think about introducing and suggesting that it's okay to use another mind-altering drug, as I said, that provides absolutely no benefits, only a downside, except in the case of medical need.
Well, I had the pleasure of running into Senator Richard Ross. He was holding a fundraiser for somebody running for Mass GOP State Committee, Janet Lombruno and Ed McGrath, last week. And he actually made the trip out to Colorado to talk to the Colorado leaders about, how the legal marijuana process is going out there. They came back, Senator Ross came back and said, the people of Colorado are saying, you don't even want this in your state. So I don't even understand why we're talking about it. It's scary.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad they did do that because, I've been following it, of course, and I even challenged the Attorney General, it was Holder at the time, and asked when the president came out publicly and said, look, marijuana is not any worse than alcohol. We know for a fact that, of course, not only is it a violation of federal law, but in addition to that, the fallout that they're having in Colorado, they're seeing an uptick in motor vehicle accidents because of reaction time. They're running into all sorts of problems now with this problem of marijuana, including the cartels moving into Colorado to try to take over the business. So there's no upside to this for anyone except for people that need it for medical purposes. And I just hope that, at least in Massachusetts, that the legislature will overwhelmingly vote it down.
Well, I hope so, too. I mean, it's very, very scary to me that we're even having the conversation. The other big thing is the opiate problem. I mean, it's gotten a lot of press. I think Governor Baker has done a phenomenal job to bring it, you know, out of the shadows and into the conversation piece. But it must be something that dominates your office every single day.
Well, there's no question. I mean, we're seeing more and more people detoxing here. We're not really a detox facility. No prison really is. We have little bed space, even for people out on the outside, to deal with this this problem. There's not enough counseling services to get, you know, support families to help them keep their children away. And we need to do more education. I think the governor's absolutely right, and I applaud him for taking a strong stand and making it a top priority for his first term. This is just, I mean, we saw in the last three years, out of 351 cities and towns in Massachusetts, we've had people dying of opiate overdoses in 258 out of 351. And in 2014, we've had about 1,256 overdoses from opiate-related overdoses. So, look, and the other part of this is, of course, the big concern was around things like, you know, codeine, heroin, hydrocodone, morphine, oxycodone, and fentanyl. But the problem is we started to see things plateau on the prescription side of the opioids, and now we're seeing a huge spike in the heroin use, which is really part and parcel to the opiate problem. So it's a very, very difficult issue. The heroin's much cheaper and easier to get than the prescription drugs now because there are more regulations in place to, you know, sort of corral doctors and some of these prescription companies and so forth. So now we're just seeing a spike in the heroin, which is even more dangerous because it's less expensive and kids are going and people are going back to this less expensive but very dangerous drug.
So, Sheriff, we've had Sheriff Lou Evangelides and Peter Katusian on our show, and they all seem to have a lot of programs to actually keep people out of jail and get the proper treatment for them. I assume Bristol County has something that's similar. Can you share what you're doing down there?
Well, sure. I mean, we have reentry plans that when people that we know are involved, drug involved, we create, in the last 6 months of their sentence, we create these exit plans for them to let them know where the programs are going to be in their community, what times the programs are, the schedules. We actually now have people who track these individuals when they get out to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing and conforming to the treatment. Now, we don't have, I wouldn't tell you we'd have 100% success, obviously. We have far less than that. But the point is, we're raising the education level. We're taking proactive steps to make sure these people don't continue and go back out into the community and use drugs, and at the same time making sure that we're dealing with our pretrial, which is a new phase in trying to deal with this problem for these pretrial individuals, getting them introduced to these, not just the education component, but when they leave, making sure that if they don't have a sentence, that they're going into treatment and not getting involved, make sure they understand how serious this is with regards to the number of deaths that are plaguing our state.
Yeah, basically, as you said, there's something around 1,256 died last year. That's four a day, basically. So potentially, while this show's been airing, a person died from heroin or some opioid that's killed them.
Right, and the important thing right now is that we really need to really make this an issue that everybody's talking about, make sure that we're increasing our resources to families the people who are addicted for rehab and counseling, and use some non-traditional approaches for things like, you know, police practices and what we're doing in trying to, when we cross these people's paths, whether they've committed a crime or not, particularly if they haven't committed a crime, but we believe that they're involved, to try to convince them, which is sort of an untraditional thing that law enforcement's done in the past, but convince them that, listen, you need to get into a treatment program and start handing them things that are going to direct them to those places, hoping to at least minimize a percentage of people either dying or families going through the tragedy of such a loss. So this is something that we have to do. We have to look at differently, and we've got to really be aggressive about it.
You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. We're joined by Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgkins. When we come back from the break, I want to talk about what he's doing in the middle schools because I think it's a very important piece. And then I also want to pick up on his opening statement about Homeland Security. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll pick up the conversation with Sheriff Hodgkins. You're listening to All Politics is Local on WCRN.
You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
Good morning, New England. You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. Join the conversation at 508-871-7000. I want to pick back up the conversation with Bristol County Sheriff. And you're working out of your office, you're working on a lot of things, and one of the things that I think is very, very impressive is the amount of work that you're putting in with the middle schools in your area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, we're doing an awful lot of work on anti-bullying. Our program has been identified as the model for the state by the Department of Education, where we actually go in and teach the teachers, for example, how to identify bullying, what the law is about reporting bullying, and how to deal with the problem. We also provide that training for parents around the issue of bullying, and as well as, of course, the students and how we can encourage them to report bullying and to try to help us in preventing bullying from existing in the environment, education environment. The other thing that we do is, of course, the Project SLAM, which is Students Learning a Message, where we actually bring the students to our facility. They get a chance to hear from inmates directly, as well as be able to take a tour of the facility to understand what they've explained in the way of how limiting life is for them with regards to choices, what they wear, whether or not they could call their mother or their father when they're sick, a lot of those types of things that kids often don't think about. The other thing that's come out of that program that's been very, very helpful is some of the inmates are very open, and on three separate occasions, we had an inmate who had talked about the fact that he had been sexually abused and wasn't using that as an excuse as to why he ended up in jail, but having brought that up, afterwards, we generally let the kids talk to the inmates, you know, sort of in that same room, but obviously under supervision, but there are people. And in three separate incidents, we had children walk up to the inmate because they felt comfortable after he had said it and said, listen, I'm being sexually abused as well. And we were able to intercede in all three of those cases to get that child help that they needed from the authorities. So it's in addition to being a great education program, it's also been for us an opportunity to get some kids who were otherwise being victimized under the radar and get them the help so that didn't continue. We're also doing an awful lot on internet safety. We're informing the kids about the importance of responsible use of social media because it can ruin their potential for a great career or college. And also the concerns around the internet bullying that goes on with in relation to some kids, you know, ultimately committing suicide. We've seen a number of those things happen around the country. And as well, of course, the change now in the threats. When we were growing up, of course, at least when I was, I remember my parents reminding us and the teachers, if anybody stops their car along the way and tells you to get in the car or they want to take you, your mother asked them to give you a ride home or whatever, to go to the nearest house and call the police or ask for help. In this case, they're not doing much of that anymore. They're coming right into the kids' bedrooms through the media, through social media, and luring kids either out of their homes or coming there and causing harm to them and to their families. So we really try to impress upon them the real dangers of talking to people on the internet that they don't know, making sure that they're being responsible in their use, and make sure they're not doing sexting and those other kinds of things that can otherwise, as I said, damage their reputations and their potential to get into college and go on to a successful life.
You know, you hit a chord with me there. I mean, I'm a father of a 17 and an 18-year-old kid, and some of the stories that they tell me, you know, about some of the assemblies that they have that just take place because something happened on social media that the parents have no idea that happened. So, I mean, it's a very, very important piece, and I'm glad that you brought that to the conversation this morning, because if you're not checking to see what your kids are looking at on Facebook and MySpace and Instagram, then you probably don't know what's going on in your kids' lives, unfortunately, anymore.
Right. We also have, John, a great program. We do the CERT program, which is a Citizens Emergency Response program, where at the VOTE schools we've been offering the class, where students can enroll in that class and actually when they graduate would be first responders to stabilize the situation. They learn basic first aid. They learn about proper reporting to the authorities. How to sort of stabilize until the actual first responders get there, and when they graduate, they each get a knapsack that's got basic supplies in there for emergency response, and that's proven to be a really good program, and a program that's really encouraged kids to not only understand the concerns and the threats out there, but the individual responsibilities we all have to respond when someone's in need and try to help minimize any future issues for anyone else that might be in the area.
It is a scary world, and speaking of being a scary world, when you first came on and joined us this morning here on All Politics is Local, you talked about the Homeland Security piece. You were down in Washington, and you had some concerns about the administration. Is there anything that we can talk about this morning?
Well, sure. I mean, I spoke to the Secretary of Homeland Security around, of course, immigration. I've been working on that since 1999, and I would tell you that I'm very concerned about the federal government's sort of tacit encouragement for people to come across the border here in the United States, which is creating, not in every case and not in every individual, but in a much larger way, an incredible burden on the American people and the legal residents who are here with regards to the overcrowding in our schools, the costs associated with having special ed teachers, the increased medical cost, housing, and then, of course, the crimes that are happening with these gang members that are coming across and are committing crimes, dealing drugs. And this whole notion, I told the secretary, the whole notion that somehow we're helping these kids escape gangs, that there was a great cartoon that was published recently, and it said, three individuals come running up to the U.S. border. They tell the border agent, "Hey, listen, you got to let us in. You got to let us in." He said, "Why do I need to let you in?" They said, "Because we're running from gangs." And he said, "Well, where are you from? Are you from Guatemala, Honduras, or Chicago?" And when you think about it, it really captures the essence of this whole issue. Most of the gangs in California, or the real vicious ones, were all exported from those countries and into our country. And today, they rule the roost in different areas. 95% of the murder warrants, outstanding warrants for murder in Los Angeles, are for illegals. So we're not, look, this idea of mothers, and this is going on, John, all on the border and in these countries, mothers are handing their children off to coyotes that work for the drug cartels. They're paying them about $5,000 to $7,000 to get their child into this country. The president has made it so easy that when a minor comes across, all they have to do is walk up to a border agent and say, "Listen, I'm here. I'm leaving my country because I'm afraid." And we have to take them in for at least 2 years till they have a hearing. Most of them never go to the hearing because you can't find them, and so they ultimately are somewhere off into the fabric of America. But here's the problem: these mothers are giving their daughters, for example, birth control pills. And just take this one example. So they hear their daughter birth control pills because they know that their daughter is going to get raped at least once by this coyote and maybe who knows who else along the way. The child finally gets to America with no support to deal with that trauma, no family support, no real community support as they know it from the land they lived in. They're shipped off to some state, put with some foster care, and I'm going to tell you some of that foster care in a minute. It's going to make your hair curl. I can't curl mine because I don't have much. But the point is, what they do is they put them into some foster care, legal or not, and then the child's put into a classroom in school where the child has no rudimentary understanding of their own language and probably never learn English, okay, because of that. The child doesn't know any of the people in the classroom, is probably going to be likely the target of the bullies and making fun of because the person doesn't speak English and whatever else. Then the child goes home after school and goes back into this neighborhood. When the child walks out of the house, guess who's going to be the first target of the American predators, the weakest link in the neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps she gets raped again or God knows what else. So don't tell me that we're helping these children. If we want to help these kids, what we need to do is deal with these corrupt governments over there that are not using their judicial system to corral these gangs and these other people and deal with their problems. If they're not going to do it, then we need to cut their aid until they learn to do it. And when we start cutting their aid, they'll figure it out real quick that we better do something because, frankly, they're using that money for themselves, a lot of these governments. Not all, but a number of them. And they don't have justice systems that really have teeth in them. And I've talked to kids from Guatemala, and they've told me that. They'd rather live in their own country. They just want to, you know, if we're going to give them aid, let's make them be accountable for the money we give them. Now, the other thing I want you to know is that, and you may have seen this, AP reported just recently that the federal government, now think about this in the context of the Department of Child and Family in our state. Imagine that they would do this. The federal government has suspended the FBI background checks on anybody who wants to be a sponsor of these kids coming into this country. They've also said that you no longer have to give original documentation of your birth certificate or other identification that they need to prove who you are, who you say you are, as a sponsor. There are 3,400, John, 3,400 people on the sponsor list, the federal government sponsor list, who have criminal histories, from homicide to rape to sexual abuse, and on and on and on. And I've talked to a reporter recently who has just done some interviews with a number of people at an agency that has operating in six states, gets almost close to $500 million over, I think, the last few years. And there is all kinds of things going on that are being passed off to cartel members for sexting and human trafficking and all kinds of things. And this is going on in our own country. So what's happening is the federal government is sponsoring, really, this, encouraging these kids to come here, then relaxing any rules that are going to make them become victims even more than they've already been, and then suggesting to the American people that this is good for them and good for America. It's outrageous what's going on. And I told the Attorney General, look, the Title 8 of the U.S. Code, Section 1327, says that it is against federal law to conceal or harbor anyone that you know to be in this country illegally. When they got rid of secure communities, when President Obama did,
oh yeah,
and replaced it with this PEP program, Priority Enforcement Program, they basically broadened the window for people who are here illegally, even after they commit crimes, to stay here. So what's happened is, for example, you cannot be considered for deportation or action until you've been convicted, not picked. Charged, convicted of at least three misdemeanors.
Hey, Sheriff, can we hold you on over after the news, or do we let you go?
Sure, I'll stick on.
Hey, thanks. You're listening to All Politics is Local here on WCRN. Time for CBS News. Good morning, New England. You're tuned to All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. He's been gracious enough to hang on after the news. We're talking to Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgkin. Hudson, I'm stumbling on the name there. Excuse me, I apologize about that. Sheriff, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here, yeah.
Hey, you know, you were talking about some scary things right before the break about Homeland Security. You know, it's I agree, you know, with all the politicians who say, if we don't have a border, we don't have a country. To me, it seems very simple. We have to protect our borders. My words, President Obama is not protecting our borders. It's got to be a huge concern to people. We're sort of insulated from it here in the Northeast, but, you know, I've spent time out, you know, in the Midwest and out on the West Coast. It's a huge problem out there. Why is nobody doing anything about it?
Well, first of all, we're not at all distant from it. The states throughout the United States are now becoming border states because the federal government's shipping these people and allowing these people to move all over the country. And in some cases, as you know, they're flying them to different locations and what have you. Why are they not doing anything about it? I think most people can only surmise it has something to do with politics with regards to votes, thinking that they're going to garner some favor with the immigrant community by allowing relatives or friends to come here. There is no real other explanation that makes any sense, because what's happening here is that, as usual, politics is being put above public safety interests. And when you think about the number of people coming in here illegally, and the president sort of encouraging it by saying, look, this is, these people, this is what America's about. We're about bringing people, taking care of people as refugees and all of that. They're not all refugees, and that's a misuse of the term with regards to the president. But, look, it's no secret. Everybody in law enforcement will tell you this. They have basically completely marginalized ICE to a point where they've paralyzed the enforcement officers from doing their jobs. They've pulled the border people back. They've really made – they now, the president's just recently again issued this catch-and-release thing where you not only have – as soon as you catch them, you have to release them. You can't track where they go. So I've never seen anything like it where an administration would try to protect the people that are known violators of our laws at the expense of the protection against, lawbreakers for the American people. And honestly, what's happened with ICE, and I can tell you, and I said this to the secretary during my conversation at the National Sheriff's with him. I said, I have agents in a neighboring state that told me they have 10 outstanding felony warrants for illegals who had committed crimes, were deported, and have come back. And once you come back in, it's a felony. And now these felony warrants are on file. They have 10 of them in this neighboring state. And they are not allowed, according to their higher-ups, to go get these guys, even though they know, they believe they know where they are, until such time as they commit another crime. Now, did we learn nothing from Catherine Steinle's murder out in California, where she was shot while she was walking down a boardwalk with her father,
right,
in the middle of the day? I mean, this is what's going on. And you cannot deny the fact that the policies of this administration are promoting this kind of thing and putting all of us at risk. And we know, for example, that ISIS has been working the borders. We know that. We know that they're getting in that way. We've got evidence of upticks in the cartels pushing more drugs through. They're using some of these kids coming across the border as a diversion to draw border people over that way, and then they bring in bigger supplies in the area away from the diversion. So there's all kinds of things going on. We know it. And look, I was over in Israel with 16 other sheriffs. We went to all three borders, went to West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, talked with the officials there. And I've been saying this for a long time. What we need to do is bring the Israelis in here, sit with our people, and develop once and for all a comprehensive border security plan. Nobody's better at it than the Israelis. Secure our ports of entry, e-verify. Get these systems up and running. You want to talk about reforms after that, then fine. But it makes no sense to start creating these reforms and keep saying we're going to empty the pipe out and let people stay here, never capping the pipe, and just telling the American people it'll get better.
From your lips to God's ear, Sheriff, can we do that, and can we do that tomorrow? Because, our national security, my children's, your children's, your grandchildren's security is all in vague. And if we're playing politics with national security, shame on our leaders. Hey, Sheriff, there's a couple people that are calling in that might be interested in talking to you, but you might be taking a phone call or two?
Okay. Sure, absolutely.
Let's go to Tim in Hudson real quick, because he's been holding the longest. Good morning, Tim. Thanks for joining us and talking to the Sheriff.
You're welcome. Hopefully I'm coming in loud and clear, and I want to say hello to the sheriff.
Hi.
Hi. I have been active in a variety of organizations, mostly the Tea Party, school organizations, political organizations, and the one thing I'm constantly seeing is, I don't know really how to describe it, but it's like two strong kids in the playground who both see something wrong, but they're not really sure how to approach each other and help each other to handle it. they may be a little bit suspicious. Maybe they're not sure how to make the handshake, if you will.
You're referring to both parties?
What?
Are you referring to both parties?
Yes. Whereas both parties are a little suspicious of each other, maybe for a variety of reasons, most of which might not be accurate. During the Tsarnaev thing in Waltham, where everybody said Boston strong, the big weakness I saw was the police essentially said, sit down, shut up, stay in your homes, we'll take care of this. The people essentially did, which put a big dividing line right between law enforcement and the people. And in the end, it was a civilian who noticed the person hiding in the boat. I think there needs somehow for law enforcement, especially the sheriffs, to somehow find strong linkages in the community so that people feel they can work together. I'm constantly struck when I go to different events. The police are sort of off to their side or they're not really sure, and the Tea Party, just the regular average citizen, I'd like to go to them, but I don't want to look like I'm threatening or pushing or everything. There has to be maybe somebody to get the two groups together, so that way you don't have to depend on a political organization that seems to be running counter-purpose to what you're saying, like you've been describing with immigration and other things. There has to be some way for a rational interrelationship so that you, as a sheriff, don't feel you have to go to Israel or Washington to get help. You could just go to the state or your county and say, look, here's the problem. I trust you, and you to help me. Let's deal with it.
All right. Thanks, Tim. Let's have the sheriff respond. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, Tim raises a great point. I've always been a big believer. In fact, I've been doing, I just did a big immigration session to inform the public. About 300 people attended, sponsored by, believe it or not, immigrant restaurants. So I believe in that. I believe, particularly with the threats that are facing our country right now with ISIS and these lone wolves, that people need to really be educated and aware and know that we need them as much as they need us. But look, it's really important for the community and law enforcement to work together, and Tim's right, if we're really going to put our best foot forward on public safety. And believe me, the last place I would want to go is to Washington to ask them for solutions because, you know, look, these guys, it's so broken down there. They get under that dome, and the only thing they think about is, what's my position on this issue versus the guys who I look at as my enemy over here? And while they're fighting back and forth, there are people outside that building in communities across this country with their hands up yelling, hey, listen, I need some help over here. My kids were just in a school where they had a major shooting, or my parents are both out of work, or whatever, the drug issues, and on and on and on. And these guys are so busy jockeying for positions on issues that nothing's getting done. And so Tim's right. I mean, it really, from my perspective, we got to get back to the basics. You know, the government that's closest to the community and most effective for its constituents is the government that is the local government and closest. The bigger bureaucracies, as you get further out, they really don't drill down and look for answers. And frankly, let me just make this last point. When you get people who have two-year cycles that are creating legislation and doing whatever and claiming they're working on problems, they're really not giving you real sound answers because they're focused on just doing something on the surface that looks like they're addressing the problem, but they never drill down. For example, if we're going to turn this cycle around of dysfunction in our country and kids coming to jail and the rising population in our prisons, you got to deal with it on the front end of third and fourth grade. But you know what? That takes time, it takes energy, and it takes a real commitment to be willing to say we're not going to see the results for maybe 6 to 10 years. But when we do, we will have completely turned that tide. And no politician believes that by telling the public, unfortunately they don't believe this, but I think the public feels differently, if they can see you're substantively, incrementally moving in the right direction, they'll support you going forward because they know you're doing the right thing. But don't give us these surface answers that only create more problems just so you can get elected.
There you go. Hey, one real quick caller before you go. We got Dean in Fitchburg. Dean, sorry to keep you holding. You got about 30 seconds for the sheriff. Go ahead. Dean? Are you there, Dean?
John, this is Dean here.
Hey, how are you? Oh, Dean Tran. Yeah, hold on. Yeah, hold on the line. We're just going to finish up with Sheriff Hodgins here. Hey, Sheriff, thank you for taking all the time this morning. I think it's been a great conversation for everybody here on the audience of All Politics is Local. Terry?
Well, I've been impressed with all of three of the sheriffs that we've had on the program. I really think these guys are doing a great job. They care about their communities. They have great programs around the opioids that some are just starting. Some have been in place for some time. But, you know, I think the Commonwealth should be proud of its sheriffs and all of the counties from what I've seen so far, at least three sheriffs, Middlesex, and
Worcester.
Bristol and Worcester counties. Pretty good group of guys that are running those departments and doing a lot to protect our communities.
Well, John, thank you for having me on the show. And let me just say that what you're doing is very, very important for getting the word out, educating people about the issues and things that they need to be involved in. And frankly, you're making a difference in helping America move forward and be safer, and we appreciate it very much.
Well, that means a lot to us. Thank you for taking the time on a Sunday morning. Tell Brock we said hello, too.
I sure will.
All right, you have a great weekend, sir.
You too.
Thank you.
You're tuned to All Politics is Local, and when we come back from the break, we'll be joined by Dean Tran, who is running for state rep out in the Fitchburg area. So we thank him for holding on the line and calling in, and we'll be back. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830.
You're listening to All Politics is Local in Massachusetts on New England's News and Talk Radio, 830 WCRN. Once again, here's your hosts, John Featherston and Terry Hendricks.
11:48 on your Sunday morning. You're tuned to All Politics is Local on WCRN 830. He's Terry Hendricks. I'm John Featherston. We're still joined in the studio by Charles Grillo, who's running for the Massachusetts State Committee on Tuesday, March 1st. And we're joined on the phone by Dean Tran, who is running for state rep in the Fitchburg area. Dean is currently a city councilor in Fitchburg. Got an important debate coming up tomorrow at the Weston Auditorium. Good morning, Dean. Thanks for taking a couple minutes to join us here on All Politics is Local.
Good morning, guys. Good morning, Terry. Good morning, John. Good morning, Charles.
So what's going on here? You've been door knocking. I've been talking to you a couple times during the week to have you come on and invite you on the program, and you've been out door knocking like nobody I've ever seen, so good for you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your campaign.
Yeah, sure. Actually, you're interrupting my door knocking, John, but...
Well, you need a break. You know, take a break.
I'm happy to join you this morning. Yeah, our campaign is doing very well. And, we're full steam ahead, spending a lot of time door knocking, reaching out to people through phones, and getting our messages out. I've been a city councilor at large in the city of Fitchburg for the past 10 years. I was just elected to my sixth term, being the top vote getter in Fitchburg in November. And then I decided to run for a state rep. It's an open seat. The former state rep was Stephen Diancalli, who was elected as the mayor. I've spent 30 years in the city of Fitchburg, well invested in the city. I have family, I'm married, and four of my kids in the public school system.
Well, great.
That's about it.
So how's it going? I mean, you got a big debate tomorrow night. Tell us a little bit about the debate.
Well, we have a big debate tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Basically, it's the usual debate held by the Center of Enterprise in conjunction with the Fitchburg State University. It's one and only debate that we're having for this race, and I'm looking forward to spending my time conveying my messages to the audience and debating with the other candidate, my opponent.
Very good. Hey, I'm looking at one of your push campaign pieces here. I'm looking at the picture of your beautiful family. You're outvoted at home, it looks like. You've got, what does it look like, three daughters and a young son and a beautiful wife. Good for you. And you've been, your six terms as a city councilor?
Yes, it is.
Good for you.
I also have a female cat at home, too.
So you're just outvoted everywhere. Good for you. So tell us a little bit about your platform and why people should vote for you for state rep.
Well, there's a clear distinction between myself and the other candidate. The biggest part of my platform is economic development for the city of Fitchburg and this district itself. As a city council at large, I
I started the discussion on economic development, and I helped create the economic development infrastructure and foundation on the local level. That's including proposing the economic development director position, and then go on building the foundation for that. So we have an infrastructure in place locally in the city. What I'd like to do is bring my ideas and my innovative ways of doing things to the state level, and possibly attract businesses and companies to the city. So that way we can, my goal is to decrease the unemployment rate in the city of Fitchburg, and currently it's at 6.2%.
Wow.
Other distinctions, like I said, I'm the only candidate who has graduated from the public school system. I have 4 children in the public school system on all levels, high school, middle school, elementary school, and preschool. So I know exactly what the district school's needs are, and I will be advocating for that as well at the state level.
Well, good for you. We've got a friend of yours in the studio, Charles. Say good morning to Dean, and tell us a little bit about what you guys got planned for today. You got some door knocking going on and the campaign office, and why don't you tell us all about that?
Yeah, I was with Dean yesterday, and in half hour when I leave here, I'll be heading back out to meet Dean and the team so we can do some more door knocking.
Yeah, it's a nice day for it.
Absolutely, and yesterday was a nice day to speak to the voters about the issues. And I want to say, Dean, congratulations on receiving the endorsement of the National Federation of Independent Businesses.
Thank you, Charles.
That's huge. That's huge. Good for you.
It is huge because that association is one of the nation's leading association on advocacy for small businesses, and that is a huge platform of my campaign.
And you've got a website. Why don't you tell us a little about the website and how people can get in touch with you?
Actually, people can get in touch with myself and the campaign in both ways. I have a website, www.deantran.com. or Dean Tran for State Rep Facebook page, and all my contact information and everything you can find about me on both ways, the website and the Facebook page.
Great. You were with Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito the other night. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that as well?
I was. It was a great event. We packed the room that we held. It wasn't really a fundraiser to me. I called it a celebration of our efforts thus far. And we had a great crowd that showed up, very diverse. I mean, people of all ages, people of all professional backgrounds, gender and race. And I'm very proud of that. That is the base of our support. And we're also looking forward to the governor coming into the city and the district next Saturday to lend his support as well as door knocking with me.
That's great. I'm looking at your push piece here. You immigrated to the United States at the age of 5, and you are the first and only Vietnamese American elected in Massachusetts. So good for
you.
Good for you. And you're running as a Republican, correct?
I am running as a Republican, and I think it's been quite a while since there has been a elected Republican in this district.
Well, good. You know, hey, we wish you the best of luck. Anything that we need to know or anything we can do to help, please let us know. But go to Dean's website, deantran.com. It's Dean, T-R-A-N. He's running for state rep. The election is on March 1st, 2016. It's a special election. Dean's a great guy, and he's going to need your support. So please help him out. Dean, thanks for taking a couple minutes. Go knock on those doors, man.
Thank you, guys. And Terry and John, you guys are more than welcome to join us and door knocking, too.
We'll be there to help. All right. Thanks, Dean.
Thank you, and good luck.
Bye.
Thanks for taking a couple minutes. Hey, Charles, we want to give you another plug about your race for state committee. Tell the people a little bit more about you and how they can get involved.
Well, before I start with that, I appreciate that, but I just want to give the address to the campaign office for Dean Tran. Like I said, when I leave here, I'm going to be heading over there to help Dean Tran door knock. The address is 348 Lunenburg Street, L-U-N-E-N-B-U-R-G.
Yeah, Lunenburg.
Lunenburg, excuse me.
Yep.
And the phone number for the office is 978-399-4970. It's a great day to door knock. Appreciate to see you guys out there in the field today.
Get a little light exercise. And
it's a beautiful Sunday.
Meet some nice people out there in the Lunenburg-Fitchburg area.
Yep, and as far as my race is concerned, I need the ones that are going to be pulling the Republican ballot on March 1st from Brookline, Newton, and Wellesley. I would really appreciate your consideration and vote on March 1st. My name is Charles Grillo, and I'd like to thank John and Terry for allowing me to be on the air with
you. It's been great to have you in here.
It's our pleasure.
And now my favorite part of the program. Terry's moment in history, this day in history.
Well, I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to read an article that was in the Washington Post, and it's about global warming, and this is out of the Washington Post. The Arctic Ocean is warming up, icebergs are growing scarcer, and in some places, the seals are finding the water too hot. According to a report to the Commerce Department from Konsulloft at Bergen, Norway, reports of fishermen, seal hunters, and explorers all point to a radical change in climate conditions and hitherto unheard of temperatures in the Arctic zone. Exploration expeditions report that scarcely any ice has been met as far north as 81 degrees 29 minutes. Soundings to a depth of 3,100 meters show the Gulf Stream still very warm. Great masses of ice have been replaced by moraines of earth and stones, the report continued, while at many points, well-known glaciers have entirely disappeared. Very few seals and no white fish are found in the eastern Arctic, while vast shoals of herring and smelts, which have never before ventured so far north, are being encountered in the old seal fishing grounds. Within a few years, it is predicted that due to the ice melt, the sea will rise and make most coastal cities uninhabitable. Well, folks, guess what? I apologize. I neglected to mention that this report was from November 2nd, 1922, over 90 years ago. So the Earth is not coming to an end. We might blow ourselves up, you know, with atomic weapons before, you know, the Earth is so hot. So
the good news is we'll be hearing again next Sunday.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. We're going to have a special guest. We'll be joined by State Rep Chris Walsh.
Yes. Yes, Chris Walsh is in Framingham. He's actually the only person elected to the Massachusetts legislature that's an architect.
There you go. Hey, vote for Dean Tran. Support Charles Grillo. You've been listening to another edition of All Politics is Local here on WCRN 830. Go to our website, allpoliticsislocalma.com. We'll talk again next Sunday. Enjoy the weather, everybody.
Have a great Sunday.